Welcome to Your New Mexico Government. I'm your host, Kaliole Colonna. Help. That's the four-letter word that's on everyone's minds in this new world. Today, we're going to focus on those whose access to help is limited and has been limited for far too long. Our podcast is focused on COVID-19, and we're so glad that KUNM is giving us some time on the airwaves. We'll be here all week long, 8 p.m., so tune in. Yesterday, we covered New Mexico's jails and prisons during the pandemic, but we still want to hear from you. If you're behind bars right now and would like to share your experience, we've got a hotline and we'll play your messages on our future shows. Call 505-218-7084, or maybe you have a family member who's incarcerated and want to share your concern. That number again, 505-218-7084, or you can email us at yournmgov@gmail.com. Homelessness, acknowledged and ignored. Why did I put it that way? Well, while many people understand that homelessness is an issue that must be fixed, very little has been done about it, particularly on a national scale. Now that we all face a new world and a new way of life as we adapt to the COVID-19 pandemic, we must recognize that the homeless are in grave danger. Today, we talk with journalists, activists, and officials about not only the problems facing the homeless amid the pandemic, but what can be done to help. All that coming up later, but first, executive producer Marisa DeMarco is here with a quick rundown of what we know today, Tuesday, March 31st, as of 5 p.m.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, is considering whether to advise people to wear non-medical masks when they're not at home. So far, the advice has been not to do that unless you're coughing or sick. But the CDC director says new data is showing people who don't have symptoms are transmitting coronavirus at a high rate. He also said the virus is 3 times more infectious than the flu. But the CDC is worried a recommendation like that might cause people to buy up the kind of masks that healthcare workers need so desperately right now. If people don't practice social distancing around the United States for at least another month, the White House says the death tolls are going to be bad. With no physical distancing at all, models show as many as 2 million deaths. With physical distancing, it could still hit 240,000, according to the White House task force. Here in New Mexico, the governor gave an update late this afternoon. Chiefly, she says people here really have to stay at home unless they have an essential outing. She said that order is going to last past April 10th and likely into May. The feds are talking until the end of April. The state increased its ability to test people. So while it used to be that only folks who showed certain symptoms should be tested, the governor announced a change. People who don't have symptoms but who have been in close contact with someone who has COVID can get tests. People who don't show symptoms but who are in nursing homes can get tests. And you don't need a doctor's referral anymore to get one if you go to a Department of Health testing site. That Army Field Hospital is coming to Albuquerque, but it's unclear where it will go. The governor also said they're going to convert the old Loveless in Albuquerque into a place that can handle COVID patients. And they're looking around the state to do the same to other buildings. County clerks here are calling for the Supreme Court to issue an order so the June primary election can be done entirely by mail. For Your NM Government, I'm Marisa DeMarco.
In order to get an authentic picture of what some homeless people are experiencing in the age of COVID-19, KUNM newsroom director and public health reporter spoke with Jonathan Stubbs, who's experienced homelessness and who now lives in a group home.
I'm currently staying in a ministry called Underhill Construction. We provide housing, career development opportunities to the underserved. We do have stuff like counseling, and we do a lot of stuff, you know, but most everybody here has either had an addiction or has experienced homelessness, and they basically take in anyone. We kind of have been very busy around here. We usually run 3 charity enterprises, but we're kind of deeming ourselves as non-essential at the moment, so we're kind of all been kept on the property. It's pretty nice because it's like a 3-acre property. We got a bunch of kennels, and we have animals and livestock here, and we have a garden and a pond and all kinds of grass and trees, and it's really nice.
Cool. And you've been there like a couple months, right?
Yeah. The 24th will be 4 months, 24th of April. So I've already been here quite a while. Time just flies so quick. Yeah, it's working out, and I have my dogs here, which is just really cool because you don't always have a lot of options when you have your dogs.
So how are you doing and your dogs?
We're doing really good. You know, we have a lot of time on our hands, and it's just been a period of great reflection and I help run a store over there at San Mateo and Central. As we know, the area is very grief-stricken with a lot of poverty, crime, homelessness. We get a lot of people in looking for clothes and food and just kind of looking for prayer and just kind of moral support. So I definitely feel like it's kind of like being on the front lines as a ministry.
Wow, thanks for doing that. What's changed most in your sort of day-to-day in the last couple of weeks since the pandemic?
Certainly my attitude. Definitely feeling grateful and just fortunate and blessed to be somewhere safe where I'm fully accommodated as far as having access to hygiene supplies, clean laundry, a shower, and just basic things like the ability to brush my teeth and wash my dogs and kind of just have a place that's sanitary and sane. You know, if I was out there right now, I wouldn't be doing so good. A lot of stuff is closed down and resources are kind of dwindling, and a lot of the outreach teams are taking extra precautions of keeping everybody safe, and it would be pretty hard right now.
Right. And you used to spend a lot of time at the public library downtown, right? That's closed.
Yeah. And that was really one of the only places for people to go was the public library when it was raining or snowing, really cold or windy. And that's not an option for a lot of people right now. So there's going to be a lot of people sleeping on sidewalks, out in the streets, and really just no place to even spend the day.
What do you think people in the homeless community need right now?
Well, you know, it's always been housing. It's always been money. It's always been a lot of things. But, you know, I think what the homeless community needs is community cooperation. You know, people that are actually willing to go up to someone, you know, that's just going to be labeled as a bum or something and actually ask them what they need. A lot of times people think everyone just needs more handouts. And really that's not the case. What a person needs is security. What a person needs is the feeling of independence.
What do you think the local and state government should be doing to help right now?
As we heard a couple months ago from the pushback of the shelter, what we need to do is just fix up small houses. We need to make more group homes.
We just heard that the Santa Fe city government is taking over some dorm rooms, like 150 beds. Do you think Albuquerque should be doing something like that to house unsheltered people right now?
I would definitely say so. Santa Fe is a really ill-equipped community when it comes to taking care of those in need. I know they have a small interfaith shelter named Pete's Place. I actually used to stay there. They also have a place called St. Elizabeth, which is also, they're both faith-based. And they get very little funding. There are actually a lot of people on the streets in Santa Fe. And the fact that a smaller city like that is stepping up to take extra measures really shows that Albuquerque, having an abundance of resources, could be doing a lot more.
Yeah, it seems like a really smart move, really common sense move. How are people experiencing homelessness taking care of themselves right now? I mean, do you think it's harder to do social distancing? Are people getting enough information that they need?
I know a lot of people are just doing the best they can to get a hotel. As far as taking showers and hygiene products, I really don't know how that's operating because I know a lot of those places fill up real fast. Something I've always pushed for the past many years is enforcing the law in New Mexico where it's like local businesses have to offer you water. If you go into a business and ask for water, it's illegal for them to deny you water because it's considered a basic human right. I think all public parks should have a water tap. I think all public parks should have at least 1 to 2 porta potties. And that's just not something you see.
Yeah, that's like baseline, water and restrooms.
Yeah, I even talked to the fire department a few years ago about installing a water tap at Robinson Park, and I never heard anything back from them.
All right, fire department in Albuquerque, you're on notice. So you mentioned faith-based organizations. Are there any local orgs in particular that you think have really stepped up to help the homeless community during this crisis?
I would definitely say God's Warehouse. On an average weekend, they feed about 400 to 500 people. And they're also paired with other places like the Roadrunner Food Bank and a couple other places. And they don't get nearly as much support as they could. I know that they recently just got some a little bit of state funding. I'm not exactly sure how much they got. But it's definitely a place that could, for what they do and the magnitude of what they experience and what they deal with, they could definitely get a lot more support.
Do you know anyone who's gotten sick while living on the streets recently? And what is it like to have to seek health care when you're living in that situation?
I actually currently do not know anybody who has come down with the coronavirus. and I hope that I don't. As far as I would imagine, it'd be scary. You'd probably get this feeling that you were just going to be taken, stripped down, and then locked up in a quarantine. I mean, I'd imagine it wouldn't be good news at all. You know, people are panicking. People are having a really hard time dealing.
Well, Jonathan, I hope you stay really safe. Thanks for your work in doing outreach there, and thanks for talking to me.
Awesome. Have a good day. Bye.
Part of our coverage, we want to bring you stories from journalists. Next, joining me, Albuquerque Journal reporter Elise Kaplan, whose story Exposed and at Risk ran in the Sunday edition of the paper just as this all got started. Elise, thank you for being with me. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. I'm doing well. I'm doing well. You and everyone in your family and your friends are feeling okay right now?
Yeah, we're hanging in there, checking in regularly and hoping for the best.
Yes, that's what we all must do at the very least, that and wash our hands. So let me ask you, what brought that story to your mind first thing when this pandemic became real for everyone in Albuquerque?
I've done some reporting in the past on homeless populations, and it just really struck me that a lot of the things we were being told to do, wash our hands, stay at home, you know, stay far apart from each other, social distancing, might be a lot more challenging if you're in a space where you don't have a home. So it's just something that I thought I should kind of look into and see what was being done to kind of address that population and see what special kind of risk factors they have given their situation.
Now, when you were reporting it, what really stood out to you? Was there like a particular moment or interview that really struck you?
Not exactly. I mean, I think it was right in the very beginning. Everybody was still trying to gear up for it. I think it was like the first weekend after everything started to really come to New Mexico and started to ramp up. So I think it still felt a little bit distant. I did walk around downtown with a photographer and just try to talk to homeless people themselves about how they're feeling. And I think it was still a little too early for people to be really feeling a lot of it yet. And honestly, they were like, we have a lot of other things to worry about, too. And we're not necessarily in the full coronavirus panic yet themselves. Though on the provider side, it was definitely something they had been thinking about for a long time and gearing up for to try to prevent an outbreak at a shelter or among those populations.
Well, what are advocates and volunteers and providers really trying to make sure that people who are experiencing homelessness know? What are they trying to make sure that they know?
I think they're trying to just keep them isolated if they might have COVID-19. Trying to keep them from spreading it amongst themselves, trying to keep it from spreading in the shelters or in encampments or things like that, and trying to give them as much knowledge as possible to keep things clean as possible and keep themselves as safe as possible.
Yeah, that's going to be very, very difficult. Now, what do you think people who haven't experienced homelessness should know that they already don't?
I think this is a really tough situation for a lot of us. I think we're all kind of adjusting to a weird new normal. And I think when you have a lot of extra stressors in your life already, you're living on the street, you may not know where your next meal comes from. You may not know where you're going to sleep that night. You may have your stuff stolen, or just don't kind of know if you're going to have enough money to buy a meal or buy a bus ticket. I think that this could add a whole lot of extra complications to an already very complicated existence right now.
Mm-hmm. So it's like more of a measure of, as you leave the house to get supplies and food and things, be mindful of your interactions with people, because you necessarily don't know the stresses that are on top of them, given all the stresses we're collectively experiencing. Have you heard from any shelters about someone there testing positive for COVID?
Yeah, so the city has told us that they did hear of one man who was experiencing homelessness who has tested positive. He was going to be transferred to the West Side shelter. That hadn't happened Friday night when I reported that story, and I've tried to get an update but have not yet heard what's going on with him. What they're doing right now is they're screening everyone before they actually enter the shelter and seeing if they have symptoms, seeing if they have a temperature. And if they do, then they're put in an isolation or in a motel room until they can get tested. And once those test results come back positive, then they would be put in an isolation room at the shelter. It may be one person there right now, but I don't have more updated numbers. Last I heard was Friday.
Okay, well, we're talking to a couple city officials about just that. We will be sure to ask them. So, you know, we talk about the people who are in need of help, but also a conversation that people are mentioning are the people who are actually helping. So what about staff and volunteers who do this work? How is the state handling health concerns for them? Do they have everything they need, masks and gloves? And that kind of sounds like a ridiculous question, because when you turn on the news cycle locally and nationally, it's all about a lack of PPE supplies. Do staff and volunteers at the shelters feel like they're adequately stocked in supplies?
That would be a question better directed towards them, but I had talked to some city officials who said that they initially wanted to start screening everyone at the pickup sites for their West Side shelter, but because of some staffing and they didn't have enough thermometers to do it there either. So some resource issues, they actually had to scale back that plan and do it just at the actual shelter itself, not at the screening locations. So I think that would suggest that they probably don't have quite as much as they would like. Yeah. I'm sure that's true of everywhere.
Yeah, it seems to be the case on everywhere, unfortunately. Let me ask you, if someone is without a home and they're sick, are there any new ways that they can access health care?
Any new ways?
Yeah. Have any new avenues popped up as a result of the city and organizations really attempting to handle the pandemic spread and really flatten the curve?
They are testing homeless people for COVID-19 now out at the shelter. So I think that's a good positive step. So people don't have to go to hospitals or go to those testing locations themselves. I've also been hearing that Healthcare for the Homeless is trying to organize some street outreach and try to meet people where they're at more as well, though they have been doing things like that in the past, yeah, and not specific to this situation.
Are there any quarantine options for people who don't have homes currently, other than the shelters?
The city has said that they're planning on keeping some people in motel rooms, giving them motel vouchers. And I think that situation will be for when people might have symptoms and are waiting for their test results. Mm-hmm. So they don't spread it before they know if they're negative or positive.
Have you continued to report on this story? What are you hearing?
The last story I did was Friday, and I checked in with The Rock at noonday, which is a huge option for people who are getting meals or want a place to do laundry and stuff like that. And they actually made the decision to close their doors just last week on Tuesday and just do curbside pickup. And I think that was really heartbreaking for the staff there to kind of know that they no longer have a spot for people to come and gather and people to be safe and rest and hang out while all this is happening.
Yeah,
but it just seemed impossible with social distancing to continue doing that now.
I understand. That's got to be heartbreaking. That institution's been around for years and has helped out a lot of people. Wow. A lot of changes we're going through. She is Elise Kaplan, journalist for the Albuquerque Journal. She reported on a story, Exposed and at Risk. It's in last Sunday's edition of the paper, but I'm sure you can find it online. Elise, thank you so much for being with us. Do you promise to be on the show a little bit later as we get more news?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much. And I would be happy to come back anytime.
All right. Thanks. Take care of yourself. Stay healthy.
You too.
Up next on Your New Mexico Government, a conversation with the Cabinet Secretary for the Children, Youth, and Families Department for the state of New Mexico, and a wonderful interview with the Healthcare for Homeless Policy Director, Rachel Biggs. But first, these messages.
Thank you to all who donated during our quiet drive. With your help, we were able to raise 25,000 meals through our community partnership, and we reached our quiet drive goal, ensuring the programming you rely on continues to thrive. Thank you to Independent Vehicle Service and Roadrunner Food Bank for their participation in this year's partnership. And to each of you who gave to support this collaboration, thank you for supporting KUNM and helping us reach for the stars, even in this difficult time.
Welcome back. This is Your New Mexico Government. I'm your host, Khalil A. Colonna. KUNM's got us on the air every night this week, covering different aspects of how COVID-19 is affecting our community. Hear last week's episodes where we heard from tipped workers, community responders, and parents and students. You can find us on KUNM.org, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Look for Your NMGov. Today, we're talking about homelessness and COVID-19. Brian Blaylock is the Cabinet Secretary for the Children, Youth, and Families Department for the state. Executive producer Marisa DeMarco talked with him about shelters around the state for young people who run away from home or who are experiencing homelessness and survivors of domestic violence.
Thanks for being on the show again, Secretary Blaylock.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Have you heard of any illnesses at any of these shelters? I know it's kind of a big network of shelters. Have you heard of any illness at any of them?
No. And like you said, it's a big network of shelters. I haven't heard of any outbreaks currently in our shelter system. I do know that Department of Health, we have a good collaboration with them. And if there was a case of COVID positive youth or families in the shelter, we would work to get them medical treatment and then work with the Department of Health to be sure that we do a deep cleaning of that shelter before it's able to open it back up again. But what I do know is that there's capacity. And so our domestic violence shelters especially have seen a dip in demand. One of the things that we are concerned about and want to be sure that we get the word out is that for domestic violence shelters that are in your community, there's capacity and they're here and that they're ready to help.
Do you mean there's been a dip since the coronavirus health concerns and health measures started happening here in New Mexico?
That's right. I think since there was school closures, we've seen dips in child abuse reports to our state centralized intake line. And we're hearing from our domestic violence partners and the Domestic Violence Coalition that there's also been a decrease in referrals for some of them throughout the state. And the concern for us is that there's a lot of contributing factors that are here that would suggest that abuse may increase in certain places. I mean, there's a lot of stresses. People are losing their jobs. There's a lot of stress around the pandemic. And on top of that, folks are not able to be as mobile. They don't have connections to their support networks through school or through church or community. And so we have some concerns there as we're watching those referrals decrease.
Now, what if someone needed to make use of the shelter and maybe already had symptoms of COVID? Have you given some thought to how that would shake out for you all?
Yeah, I think for most of our shelters, the protocol now is if it looks like someone has symptoms, they're working with us or with their other partners to get a hotel voucher for them so that they have a safe place to stay while they're waiting those results to come back. As we continue to get more cases in New Mexico, we've been in discussions with shelters about ways that we could collaborate and work in case the shelter needed to be quarantined for a time. So then you could have COVID positive individuals going to a certain shelter and then non-COVID positive folks going to others. I've been really impressed by the collaborative work, especially of our domestic violence shelters and how much they work together with the assistance of the Domestic Violence Coalition in helping us think through those issues and those problems as they happen. It's difficult to be prepared for a pandemic, something that no one has seen unless you were alive in 1918. And so working and problem solving this on the fly has been an important part of what we're doing. I think right now with our network of hotel rooms, and then also we have a few facilities that we're repurposing specifically for youth who might be COVID positive, so that we're able to, I think, we're as prepared as we can be for a surge in New Mexico as that starts to happen.
And so you're trying to get the word out, you know, that these shelters are still in operation, they're still available, there's capacity for folks if they need to use them. What other measures is CYFD taking to kind of deal with this emerging problem?
We're doing this practice of what we're calling over-visiting. So we're checking in with youth that are in our care, whether that's through juvenile probation and they're in the community, or youth that are in our care through the foster care system, checking in with them by video calls, if they have the technology, or if not, checking in with by phone calls a couple of times a week, trying to get to them, engaging them. We're also sending educational packets home so that we can talk to them about books and science experiments they can do with common household goods and really kind of encourage that kind of activity with the family. I think some of the best things that we can do to prevent child abuse is have families working together and learning together.
It sounds like most or all of the check-ins have also gone remote. Is that right? You're mostly doing virtual check-ins with folks or phone check-ins?
So we're trying to do our part to prevent the spread of COVID, and that includes moving to video calls whenever possible to check in with our youth. Sometimes if it's a situation where the youth's doing really well or there's no safety concerns, we'll also use phone calls in order to do that. We're still doing visits for some children and youth. Sometimes it's related to safety risks. Sometimes it's a brand new placement and we just want to be sure that they have everything we need, because we want to be sure that what we're not doing is we're not withdrawing our presence and withdrawing when our families need us the most. So we want to be sure we're trying to balance between being there and being available and supporting our families and also not contributing to the spread of COVID at all. And so doing what we can remotely, but also being there in person if we need to be.
Are you worried at all that because some of these things are now happening virtually, that the people who do these checks might miss something?
I mean, that could always be the case, even if we're there physically. But I think we're using some best practices and protocols. This is something that folks all over the country are having to figure out now. Using video calls to check in with youth who are in foster care is something brand new that the federal government just allowed because of this public health emergency. We're being sure that we're checking in with the youth, with the family, with the foster parents, doing what we can to ensure that when we have those conversations, especially with older youth, it's done in a confidential space so they feel free to communicate with us. And then also being sure that with our older youth, especially, that our workers are able to use other platforms like texting in order to be sure that we're having good confidential communication so they can tell us if there's anything that they need that they might not feel comfortable saying over the phone or in a video chat.
And people are losing jobs and resources. Are you helping shore folks up who might be on the edge a little bit of losing their home or of experiencing food insecurity, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think across state government, I mean, that's an urgent need. I know Secretary Bill McCamley over in Workforce Development is getting the system ready to be able to take the money in order to get it out through our unemployment program. That's a huge undertaking. And honestly, an unemployment system is not really a system that's set up to be able to do that kind of work. And so Secretary McCamley is doing an impressive job getting that up and ready for us so that we can focus on it. I think for what we're doing is our centralized intake system and our child welfare workers and probation officers are being sure to check in with families about how they're doing, about their access to food, their access to supplies. And as we're finding families who need help with that, we're helping them. We've done door-to-door food deliveries. We've helped families find supplies and cleaning supplies when it looked like their grocery shelves were empty. And so that's it. I mean, we're in the community and we're here to help as much as we can.
Now, with regard to the shelters, what precautions are being taken at those places under the direction of CYFD to ensure the health and safety of people who go to them or who need to use them, as well as the volunteers or people who work at them?
With our shelters, we got a little head start on this, which we're really thankful for. Before this really hit the United States generally, we were working with our shelters to come up with, to be sure that they had up-to-date emergency preparedness plans and that they included infectious disease protocols. And so that was a good first step. And we didn't have to do that in the middle of the chaos of a pandemic. Like, we had started those conversations and most of those shelters had gotten that back to us before this really hit the U.S. at all, much less New Mexico, which we're very thankful for. We also have access to some emergency funding that we're making available to the shelters. That includes, it can be anything from cleaning supplies to food to any emergency activities. We have a process that we've been working with the governor's office. We've identified some hotel partners who have hotel rooms. And so we're providing hotel vouchers in case youth need to go there or families need to go there, either because the shelter's at capacity or because maybe they're symptomatic and awaiting the results of a test. And so we don't want to put them in the shelter because it might increase the risk, but they do need help immediately. So we're making sure they have a place to stay so that that can happen. And then coordinating very closely with PED, Public Education Department, to be sure that the food that's available for children during school closure is also getting to our youth who are experiencing homelessness and being sure they're not excluded. Public Education Department and the school districts have been an amazing partner on that to be sure that we're not missing out on our vulnerable children who are experiencing homelessness during this time.
And so right now, do all these places have adequate food, cleaning supplies, toilet paper?
Yeah, as far as I know, they do, or if not, they're getting in touch with us and we're helping them. I got to say the biggest bump was at the beginning of the pandemic and the height of kind of panic buying in some of our neighborhoods in New Mexico that resulted in shelters not being able to find cleaning supplies right away. And so that was a concern, but I think a lot of that's been worked out. So it wasn't really a question of funding. It was just like supply chains, but a lot of those places have been restocked at this point. And so we're in a better situation with that.
And if people want to help, like if people listening to this want to chip in and help some of these folks, is there a way for them to donate or to volunteer, anything like that?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think our local runaway and homeless youth shelters especially could use support. And so if people are able to reach out to them and to donate, whether it's food, cleaning supplies, or money, and for our domestic violence shelters as well, I think that would be a huge thing to be able to do.
These are all the questions that I have for you today, Secretary Blaylock. Thanks for being with us.
Great. Yeah, thanks for letting me.
to further along the conversation about what to do for the homeless population during the outbreak of COVID-19. I'm here with Healthcare for the Homeless Policy Director, Rachel Biggs. Rachel, thanks for being with me today.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate being part of the conversation.
Yes, we're happy to have you. Now, let me ask you, how are you and your family and friends feeling during this time?
Oh, thanks for asking. My family is scattered throughout the U.S., so it is a hard time right now because we had trips planned. We wanted to see each other. So we're struggling with that, but making do with Zoom family calls and staying in touch best we can.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Now, tell me, what have things been like for you all since this really all began? Are you seeing more people seeking mental health care and services since the start of the pandemic?
You know, that's a really good question. We have a great team of behavioral health therapists, and they are still seeing their scheduled clients through telehealth visits. We did hear through our case managers that people in our permanent supportive housing programs that are just recently housed or have been housed for quite some time in supportive housing are feeling more anxiety. You know, they're at home, they're listening to the news all day long and hearing some really scary things about the pandemic. So of course, mental health has been a big concern. Substance use, relapse, all of those things we worry about. You know, we're traditional primary care integrated health clinic, and we like to see people and meet them where they are. And, you know, the fact that we've had to change how we deliver healthcare to be more over the phone and through telehealth has definitely changed our response. But our teams are amazing and have been able to pivot really quickly to do that. So mental health care is something that we've always done, and we're doing even more of that right now, and pretty concerned about folks that are most vulnerable in our community.
How about the folks you work with? Everybody's doing well?
Yeah, we have about 55% of our staff are now working remotely. So they're working from home, and we're doing a lot of telecommuting and a lot of phone calls. And then the rest of our staff are on campus still seeing clients. And we've gone to kind of a one entry point. We're screening everyone as they come onto our health campus. But our staff are doing remarkably well, I think. We're all under a lot of stress right now, and there's a lot of uncertainty. And of course, that reflects in the staff and our clients, and we're all feeling that. But we're supporting each other, and it's been pretty amazing. We check in every single day and get to see each other on Zoom and see how we're doing. And our staff has really risen to the occasion. This is what we are set up to do. We do public health. We do, you know, crisis intervention all the time. So this is, you know, par for the course for us. It's a pandemic, and we're having to step up in different ways, but we're really built for this and ready for it.
That's really good to hear. Now, do you all have access to COVID tests?
We do, actually. We've been really lucky. We've been working with the Department of Health, and we have a few tests available to us. Right now, we are screening very rigorously. We have been for the past 2 weeks at our campus, and so far, no one has screened positive for having to get a test. So no one's risen to that level for a test yet. So we haven't actually been administered a test, but we do have access to them, and we're very grateful for that. So when the time comes, we'll be ready.
Okay. Now, as this wears on, there's a lot for us all to worry about. But is there something in particular that's going on in your mind? Some kind of essential service or supply you really don't want to go see missing? You don't want to see go missing, pardon me.
Yeah, I think one of the big topics right now for us is medication-assisted treatment and access to substance use treatment for people living on the street right now. If we have to move people into isolation, if people are being isolated, if they tested positive, we're concerned that they wouldn't have access to essential treatment for their substance use. You know, if someone's going through detox, we want to make sure they have the medicated detox available to them. Having that 24-hour nursing and medical care, we have that through our county system right now, but we know that all of our systems are being taxed, nurses are being pulled into ICU care, and we want to make sure that these essential services continue. So that's something that's really big on our mind right now. And then just getting out to people that are living on the street and making sure that we're doing what we always do, really good street outreach and street medicine, but making sure that we're able to reach people and get them the health care that they need, making sure that they have a place to isolate that's safe.
Okay. Speaking of a safe place to isolate, Elise Kaplan from the Albuquerque Journal, I interviewed her earlier, and she reported last week that a man tested positive for the coronavirus, and he was to be transported to a facility on the west side of Albuquerque on Friday. She said that the man, as far as she knew, had not been transported. Do you have any clarity on whether this man has been transported and put into basically an isolated part of the facility or not?
You know, I don't have information about that. I do know that at this time, we do not have knowledge that anyone has been tested positive for COVID, that is someone that is experiencing homelessness. I do think sometimes the terms are confusing that have been used. So sometimes someone might have screened positive to be tested and is awaiting their test results. And we're part of a pretty integrated system with the City of Albuquerque, UNM Health Sciences, the Medical Reserve Corps, obviously Healthcare for the Homeless, First Nations, homeless service providers. And we meet every single day and we talk about the coordinated public health response to people without homes. We're pretty tapped into what's going on at the Westside Emergency Housing Center. Our medical providers are there doing rounds and available almost every single day, Monday through Friday. And so at this time, we don't have information that someone actually has tested positive that is experiencing homelessness.
Now, you mentioned you're working with the city. How do you feel about the support you've received from the city?
I feel super lucky that we've been part of this collaborative to address the public health crisis right now, and in particular, the needs of people experiencing homelessness. It was really nice because we've been able to build off of a partnership that we've already had with the City of Albuquerque and UNM Health Sciences, the Westside Emergency Housing Center, and our partners. We were already working together on a healthcare coordination collaborative to deliver healthcare services to people staying at the shelter and looking at the larger healthcare system for people without homes in Albuquerque. So because we already had that in place, we were able to really pivot very quickly with our partners. And so from the very beginning, we've all been able to come together and work very collaboratively.
Excellent. Good work. How can people, our listeners, help?
We have been really fortunate to have an outpouring of people that want to help. And so what we're telling people is to obviously donate to organizations that they care about that are serving people experiencing homelessness. You can donate to Albuquerque Healthcare for the Homeless through our website. And then the City of Albuquerque has also put up a website to recruit volunteers as well. And then just the advocacy and making sure that people without homes are recognized in any kind of response, any healthcare response to the pandemic, that we're first and foremost paying attention to our most vulnerable population and people that are at highest risk for really negative outcomes from the COVID pandemic.
Excellent. I want to thank you so much for being with me. She is Rachel Biggs, Healthcare for the Homeless Policy Director. Thanks again for the work that you're doing, and thanks for being on the show. Do you promise to come on the show in a few weeks to talk about any status updates?
Oh, I promise. Thank you so much for including us. We're really happy to be part of the conversation, and thanks for thinking of people living on the street right now and the particular health impacts.
Well, it's time that we all think about each other and what's going on. This is a global thing. This isn't a state thing, city thing, county thing, or country. This is the entire planet. So we all have to start thinking about each other in that manner.
I couldn't agree more.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, I speak with the executive producer of an organization in Las Cruces that's giving hope to the homeless, and hear my conversation with the deputy director of housing and homelessness for the City of Albuquerque. First, a quick message.
Thank you to all who donated during our quiet drive. With your help, we were able to raise 25,000 meals through our community partnership, and we reached our quiet drive goal, ensuring the programming you rely on continues to thrive. Thank you to Independent Vehicle Service and Roadrunner Food Bank for their participation in this year's partnership, and to each of you who gave to support this collaboration. Thank you for supporting KUNM and helping us reach for the stars, even in this difficult time.
Las Cruces is the second biggest city in the state of New Mexico. In 2011, instead of busting up a tent city that had formed, like most administrations do, Las Cruces officials helped a camp set up on city-owned property. It was supposed to just last that winter, but it was really successful, and it's been going ever since. Now it's called the Mesilla Valley Community of Hope. We've got Nicole Martinez, executive director, with us today. Nicole, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you.
I ask this to everyone. How are you? How is your family? How's everyone feeling healthy?
I am doing well. Family is doing well at this point. Just trying to adjust to the new normal.
Yes.
It does not feel very normal.
No, it does not. It's a new world and a new reality for us all to face. And that's part of our mission here at your New Mexico government, is to inform and help people. So can you start by speaking of some of the greatest needs to the homeless during this time?
Sure. Some of the greatest needs that we have are sort of mirrored by the times right now. So, of course, needing some hand sanitizer, Clorox wipes, bleach, all the things that everyone else is having a difficult time finding. But also, we do accept donations that are in the form of tents and tarps. We do operate, as you mentioned earlier, a camp, Tent City, that we call Camp Hope, as a project of the Mesilla Valley Community of Hope. And so we move people in and out of the camp as needed and as there is room. But yeah, those remain our greatest needs at this time.
Now, how many people does your organization help?
On a daily basis, we serve between 90 and 100 people with a variety of our services. At the camp, we have currently 37 people sleeping in the camp, and that's pretty much our capacity, somewhere around that number. But we provide a lot of other services, so we are also a day shelter. So we have showers and laundry, lockers, mail services, income programs, donations, and we also have several different types of housing programs. So we have 300-plus people in their own housing units that we are supplementing.
Okay. And how are things going at the camp?
Things are going well at the camp. We have weekly meetings with the camp that we've had ever since we started. So we have a really good open line of communication with people who are residing there. I have one staff person that's dedicated full-time to the staff or to the camp. Other than that, they are self-governing after hours and weekends. And we've just continue to keep those lines open about the virus, you know, from the very beginning, making sure we were putting up notices, that we were having conversations in the meetings, that we were talking about ways to help prevent bringing the virus in, how to quarantine it, how to contain it. And so I think that that's been really helpful. You know, camp residents have been forthcoming in their concerns, their worries, their fears, their misinformation in some cases. And so, you know, having that line of communication open has been really helpful in keeping stability going and people feeling like they are getting some answers.
Yeah. And everyone is on the same page as we all deal with this pandemic. Now, have any lawmakers reached out to you? What about other organizations?
Yes, we have had several conversations with our city council and Office of Emergency Management about how we are doing, about some of the measures that we are putting in place to make sure that we're keeping clients and staff safe. We've also worked closely with the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness to talk about the measures that we're taking, but also what others are implementing as part of their practices. We do a weekly call-in with the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness and the Department of Health to talk about what's new and with the virus, and then anything else that is important for us to know or other best practices that are happening around the state or around the country that we might be able to utilize here.
I was just about to ask you, I'm glad to hear that. I was about to ask you if there was a need and a capability for organizations like yours to come together to pool resources and to create a plan of action moving forward. You all obviously have already started doing that. Do you think that this coordination will be sustainable as the threat of the pandemic lessens? And I don't think we're going to go back to what we used to call normal. There is going to be a new normal and a new reality. Do you think that this coalition will be able to stick together and move forward to make progress for the homeless population?
I do. I think in our circumstances, you know, having the New Mexico Coalition and Homelessness before the pandemic and after, you know, I think it's going to be one of those things like lessons learned and going forward, continuing a lot of these practices and these open conversations. You know, there are meetings every month with the coalition where we are able to weigh in and make contact with other homeless service providers. And here at the Mesilla Valley Community of Hope, we're in a really unique situation where we're set on a piece of city property, but we have four other agencies that are under the lease with us that also serve people who are indigent, disabled, and homeless. Mm. And we come together monthly and support each other and talk about what's working, what's not working, lessons learned, things to plan, et cetera. And so I absolutely have confidence that this is something that can be sustainable. I would love to see that in other areas and hope that this helps to bolster those relationships.
Exactly. Exactly. It's something for us to do to move forward. How are things different in Las Cruces than elsewhere in the state for people experiencing homelessness?
Well, just like what I touched on just a second ago, you know, within a stone's throw, we have other agencies co-located on our campus here. We call it a campus or an alliance of agencies. We're all right next to each other. So somebody who's experiencing homelessness typically isn't just without a home. They probably have health issues, behavioral health issues, food insecurity. They might need childcare. We have those facilities right here, all right next to each other, all on city property, all tied with a lease agreement, you know, with the promise that we will be providing services for the the people that we are intended to serve. And so because we have all of those things right here next to each other, I think that does make us really unique, and that also that we've added that extra component of having shelter as well. So, you know, having Camp Hope here also helps people in the emergency temporary setting while we work to get them permanently housed through one of our housing programs, or helping them to self-resolve, or any other type of an appropriate housing placement that's going to ultimately end their homelessness permanently.
Last question for you. More of a statement. One thing that I see is an awakening of acknowledgement of the issues that have been ignored or pushed to the side for decades here in America. Now people are realizing what needs to be fixed and addressed in society. Hopefully, this will create change. What, in your opinion and expertise, are some ways we can create lasting, sustaining change for the homeless as we recover from the pandemic?
I appreciate the statement and the question. I think, I definitely feel that there are pieces of this that have been pushed to the side, that working with people experiencing homelessness is not always a top priority for people. But I've seen a lot of people try to reach out, try to address this issue, realizing that everyone is really close to becoming homeless. It could take something like a pandemic or just, you know, a crisis that happens one day that puts everybody sort of in a more level playing field. I think one of the things that we need to remember, again, is that we should be supporting each other, that we do need to think about things and be proactive, such as rental assistance and helping people that are on the verge of becoming homeless. Because, like I said, those haven't been such big priorities in terms of putting a lot of money into housing or ending the issues of homelessness, including serving people with mental health issues or substance use issues. And so I think those are some things that during all of this we can really reevaluate or evaluate and come together to find solutions going forward that are going to help us to avoid something like this in the future, where, again, I think that we could see a lot more people experiencing homelessness and poverty than we would have thought before because of this pandemic.
That's right. That's right. And that's something we need to do, because the one thing that I've recognized is we're a lot more alike than we thought we were. And where a lot of us are in very, very similar situations. I want to thank you for being on the show, and thank you for the work that you are doing. Truly, truly appreciate it. She's Nicole Martinez, Executive Director of the Mesilla Valley Community of Hope. Thanks again for being with us.
Thanks for the opportunity, Khalil. Appreciate it.
Joining me now is Lisa Huval, who serves as the Deputy Director for Housing and Homelessness with the City of Albuquerque. Lisa, thanks for joining with me.
Thanks for having me on this afternoon.
Have you heard of any confirmed COVID cases at shelters among the people who use them or people who work and volunteer at them?
There is a network of emergency shelters in Albuquerque. The largest one is called the Westside Emergency Housing Center. Has 450 beds, serves men, women, and families with children. So I can say so far at the Westside Emergency Housing Center, about a dozen folks have been tested, but as of today, we did not have any confirmed cases. Most of those folks that have been tested have gotten their test results back and they're negative. A few are still waiting test results. We do have an isolated place for people to stay while they're waiting test results, but none of the test results have come back positive so far. We now have a process in place to screen residents twice a day, to be able to quickly test them if they are symptomatic, and then to be able to provide an isolated place for them to rest and recover if they do in fact have COVID-19. And then I have not heard yet from other shelters of having staff or residents of the shelter with a confirmed COVID-19 case.
Okay, that's good news thus far.
It is very good news, yes.
Are there any healthcare options out there right now for folks who don't have homes?
Well, I can certainly say at the Westside Emergency Housing Center, we have been working really closely with some key medical partners from day one. In particular, Albuquerque Healthcare for the Homeless, First Nations, both of those are federally qualified health centers. And then we've also been working with the Medical Reserve Corps, which is an entity that engages medical staff to provide volunteer work. And those have been three really critical partners. So we are able to offer some medical services at the Westside Emergency Housing Center. There's now Medical Reserve Corps volunteers who are out there each night of the week. Those volunteers are able to do testing on site if someone is identified as symptomatic and needing to be tested for COVID-19.
All right, that's really good. I'm glad that that's happening. Now, I got to ask you a question. Earlier today, I was able to interview Elise Kaplan from the Albuquerque Journal. She reported that a man had tested positive for coronavirus and he was to be transported to a facility on the west side, perhaps the facility you're talking about now, on Friday. She did an interview with me about an hour and a half, 2 hours ago. She mentioned that as far as she knows, the man still has not been transported. Can you speak on his status? Has he been moved to the west side facility?
Yeah, I don't have any more details on that situation. On Friday evening, we were alerted to the fact that one of the hospitals may have a patient to transport to the Westside Emergency Center who had been tested positive for COVID-19, but that transfer did not, in fact, happen. And I do not have any further information about that situation.
Okay. Is it okay if we call you in a day or two to try to get some more info?
You certainly are welcome to do that.
Now, over the weekend, my housemate texted me. It was toward the evening, a little bit early evening, and he was driving, just taking a drive to get out of the house. And he mentioned that he saw police officers approaching people who were on the street and talking to them, you know, asking them to move and leave. Now, the question is this. Are people who sleep outside or find public spaces to sleep, are they still being told to leave those spots by the police during the pandemic?
Yeah. So, you know, it is currently we do not allow folks to camp on public property. And of course, on private property owners have, you know, that's at their discretion, I guess, whether to allow folks to camp on private property. Certainly, if a private property owner asks APD to help them remove an encampment on private property, APD will respond to that. We have a process in place that we've had for a long time on how we respond to encampments on public property. And I will say that process is still in place. You know, encampments, I recognize, are a sensitive issue at any time, but especially right now. But, you know, allowing an encampment to be established and to grow presents other public health concerns. But with that said, I think we're proactively addressing the encampment situation in other ways. One is we recognize that folks living outside need access to portable restrooms and hand washing stations, particularly right now when so many places that people would usually use are closed, like libraries and community centers and even businesses. So we are, as a city, looking at where we can put some portable restrooms and hand washing stations that would allow people to just take care of basic needs with some dignity and also keep our neighborhoods clean and healthy. We also really believe that, you know, folks that are living outside in encampments are like the rest of us. Like, they need good and accurate information about how to keep themselves safe during this crisis. And so if we can get that information out to people, people can make smart and rational decisions about how to take care of themselves and the people that they care about. We have helped convene a core group of street outreach providers that are now meeting 3 times a week to coordinate their street outreach strategy. We're working with our partners on some information that we can get out to encampment residents in clear and understandable language about the COVID-19 and how they can protect themselves and keep themselves safe.
What about staffing? How is the staff holding up at these facilities? Because I'm sure they're overworked. They're very tired. They're also, you know, looking to work and help people, but also they're living throughout this pandemic like the rest of us are. How are they holding up?
So, you know, I really think I had mentioned earlier that we contract with Heading Home, a local nonprofit, to operate the Westside Emergency Housing Center, which means they provide all the staffing out at that shelter. I really think that they're some of the unsung heroes of this situation that we're all dealing with right now.
I agree.
Staff have like totally stepped up to play this role to protect folks who are staying at the Westside Emergency Housing Center and keep them safe and healthy. That includes, you know, we've got these isolation units now at the Westside Emergency Housing Center where people can stay while they're waiting for their test results. Mm-hmm. And then if there is a confirmed case, that means a core group of staff at the Westside Emergency Housing Center have had to undergo extra training in order to be able to staff those units, including how to wear the proper protective personal equipment.
Final question. You know, the economy is at a virtual standstill. Thousands of New Mexicans are out of work. Some don't believe that they'll be going back to work. They feel like their companies or businesses they work for will fold as a result of this. Yet rent is still due as of tomorrow because it's the 31st today. What programs and strategies does the city have in place to help people who cannot afford to pay their rent during this pandemic? And do you think that there will be a surge in the number of people who become homeless as this wears on?
Well, first, I think it's important that all your listeners know that the New Mexico Supreme Court placed a moratorium on evictions for non-payment of rent. They issued that order last week. And as of this date, you know, it went into effect on the date that they issued it, and there's no expiration date on it at this point. So there is a little bit of protection for renters right now. I think what's important, though, for listeners to understand who are going to have trouble paying their rent on April 1st is that moratorium does not mean don't pay your rent and you're covered. First of all, you know, you should have a proactive conversation with your landlord to see if they're willing to work with you during this crisis. If they're not, the landlord can still file an eviction in court. What the moratorium from the Supreme Court does is it gives the court the ability to stop the eviction proceeding. However, the tenant must attend the court hearing and testify, you know, make a case that they're unable to pay the rent due to changes in their income. At least in Albuquerque, folks do have the option of participating in that court hearing by phone. So that's one piece that I think is really critical because, you know, we can't, that's like kind of a system-wide response that was much appreciated and needed. I will also say we do, the city does have an eviction prevention program that we run through our health and social service centers. There's four health and social service centers in the city, one located in each quadrant of the city. People can go to the health and social service center that's in their quadrant and ask for assistance with back rent up to $500. We have a relatively small amount of funds available for that. We are looking at how we could increase funding for that. And of course, we're also, there's some funding that was part of the stimulus package that Congress passed last week. So we'll also be looking at that too to see what which of those funds we can use to help with this eviction prevention issue.
Okay. She is Lisa Huval, Deputy Director of Housing and Homelessness with the City of Albuquerque. Thank you very much for joining the show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's about all the time we have on the show today, but we have links for all the reporting we talked about in today's episode online at KUNM.org. Special thanks to all of our guests and to Hannah Colton for contributing to the show. It's time to check out the resources we heard about today. And if you want to tell us about other great community-led resources, send us an email, yournmgov@gmail.com. We'll be sure to share them. We've got a full list of youth shelters and domestic violence family shelters from around the state on a post on KUNM.org. So if you'd like to donate food or cleaning supplies to the one near you, just hit it up and we'll lead you right there. We've got a link for you, too. The full governor's speech that she gave today. She covered a lot of ground. You want to hear that. To reach out to Nicole Martinez and the Mesilla Valley Community of Hope, email hope@zianet.com. You can call them up, 575-523-2219, or head to the website, mvcommunityofhope.org. Head to the website for Albuquerque Healthcare for the Homeless. It's abqhch.org. Find the full list of resources that we talk about on every episode and opportunities to donate or help online at bit.ly/YNMG Hub. And don't forget, we want to know how things are going for you. We really want to hear about it. Call us up 505-218-7084 and we'll play your messages on our show. Or you can email us at, you should know it by now, say it with me, yournmgov@gmail.com. On tomorrow's episode, tribal concerns. Limited access to medical supplies, healthcare workers, and the internet are just some of the issues tribal leaders have been dealing with for, well, a while now. All of that is exacerbated with the current pandemic. Tomorrow on YNMG, we dive deep into these tribal concerns and COVID-19. It's an important show. Tune in tomorrow, 8 p.m. Your New Mexico Government is executive produced by Marisa DeMarco. It's produced by yours truly. News update by Marisa DeMarco. We're grateful for the contributions of Ms. Hannah Colton. The theme music is by Pope. Yes, yes, y'all. You can hear us all week long on KUNM's airwaves at 8 p.m. Online, you can find the show at KUNM.org or subscribe through iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your New Mexico Government is a collaboration between KUNM, New Mexico PBS, and the Santa Fe Reporter. Funding for our coverage is provided in part by the Thornburg Foundation and the New Mexico Local News Fund. For everyone here at Your New Mexico Government, I'm Khalil Ekolona. Thanks for listening.